and like something living as the cars rattled across the bridge, how it washed the weariness from his seatmates' faces and revealed them as they were when they first came to the country, when they were young and America seemed conquerable. He'd watch that kind of light suffuse the car like syrup, watch it smudge furrows from foreheads, slick gray hairs into gold, gentle the aggressive shine from cheap fabrics into something lustrous and fine. And then the sun would drift, the car rattling uncaringly away from it, and the world would return to its normal sad shapes and colors, the people to their normal sad state, a shift as cruel and abrupt as if it had been made by a sorcerer's wand. He liked to pretend he was one of them, but he knew he was not. Sometimes there would be Haitians on the train, and he, his hearing suddenly wolf-like, distinguishing from the murmur around him in the slurpy, singy sound of their Creole, would find himself looking toward them, to the two men with round faces like his father's, or to the two women with soft, snubbed noses like his mother's. He always hoped that he might be presented with a completely organic reason to speak to them. Maybe they'd be arguing about direction somewhere, and he might be able to insert himself and provide the answer. But there never was. Sometimes they would let their eyes scan across the seats, still talking to each other, and he would tense, ready his face to smile, but they never seemed to recognize him as one of their own. Which he wasn't, of course. Even he knew he had more in common with Asian Henry Young, with Malcolm, with Willem, or even with Jude than he had with them. Just look at him. At Court Square, he disembarked and walked the three blocks to the former bottle factory where he now shared studio space with three other people. Did real Haitians have studio space? Would it even occur to real Haitians to leave their large, rent-free apartment where they could have theoretically carved out their own corner to paint and doodle, only to get on a subway and travel half an hour? Think how much work could be accomplished in those 30 minutes. To a sunny, dirty space? No, of course not. To conceive of such a luxury, you needed an American mind. The loft, which was on the third floor and accessed by a metal staircase that made bell-like rings whenever you stepped on it, was white-walled and white-floored, though the floors were so extravagantly splintered that in areas it looked like a shag rug had been laid down. There were tall, old-fashioned casement windows punctuating every side, and these, at least, the four of them kept clean. Each tenant was assigned one wall as his personal responsibility, because the light was too good to squander to dirt, and was in fact the whole point of the space. There was a bathroom, unspeakable, and a kitchen, slightly less horrifying, and standing in the exact center of the loft, a large slab of a table made from a piece of inferior marble placed atop three sawhorses. This was a common area, which anyone could use to work on a project that needed a little extra space, and over the months the marble had been streaked lilac and marigold and dropped with dots of precious cadmium red. Today the table was covered with long strips of various colored hand-dyed organza, weighted down at either end with paperbacks, their tips fluttering in the ceiling fan's whisk. A tented card stood at its center. Drying. Do not move. We'll clean up first thing Tom'W.P.M. TX for patience. HY. There were no walls subdividing the space, but it had been split into four equal sections of 500 square feet each by electrical tape, the blue lines demarcating not just the floor, but also the walls and ceiling above each artist space. Everyone was hypervigilant about respecting one another's territory. You pretended not to hear what was going on in someone else's quarter, even if he was hissing to his girlfriend on his phone, and you could, of course, hear every last word, and when you wanted to cross into someone's space, you stood at the edge of the blue tape and called his name once, softly, and then only if you saw that he wasn't deep in the zone, before asking permission to come over. At 5:30, the light was perfect, buttery and dense and fat somehow, swelling the room as it had the train into something expansive and hopeful. He was the only one there. Richard, whose space was next to his, tended bar at nights, and so spent his time at the studio in the mornings, as did Ali, whose area he faced. That left Henry, whose space was diagonal from his and who usually arrived at 7 after he left his day job at the gallery. He took off his jacket, which he threw into his corner, uncovered his canvas, and sat on the stool before it, sighing. This was JB's 5th month in the studio, and he loved it more than he thought he would. He liked the fact that his studio mates were all real, serious artists. He could never have worked in Ezra's place, not only because he believed what his favorite professor had once told him, that you should never paint where you fucked, but because to work in Ezra's was to be constantly surrounded and interrupted by dilettantes. There, art was something that was just an accessory to a lifestyle. You painted or sculpted or made crappy installation pieces because it justified a wardrobe of washed soft t-shirts and dirty jeans and a diet of ironic cheap American beers and ironic expensive hand-rolled American cigarettes. Here, however, you made art because it was the only thing you'd ever been good at, the only thing really you thought about between shorter bursts of thinking about the things everyone thought about. Sex and food and sleep and friends and money and fame. But somewhere inside you, whether you were making out with someone in a bar or having dinner with your friends, was always your canvas, its shapes and possibilities floating embryonically behind your pupils. There was a period, or at least you hoped there was, with every painting or project when the life of that painting became more real to you than your everyday life. When you sat wherever you were and thought only of returning to the studio. When you were barely conscious that you had tapped out a hill of salt onto the dinner table, and in it you were drawing your plots and patterns and plans, the white grains moving under your fingertip like silt. He liked, too, the specific and unexpected companionability of the place. There were times on the weekends when everyone was there at the same time, and at moments, he would emerge from the fog of his painting and sense that all of them were breathing in rhythm, panting almost from the effort of concentrating. He could feel, then, the collective energy they were expending filling the air like gas, flammable and sweet, and would wish he could bottle it so that he might be able to draw from it whenever he was feeling uninspired, for the days in which he would sit in front of the canvas for literally hours, as though if he stared long enough, it might explode into something brilliant and charged. He liked the ceremony of waiting at the edge of the blue tape and clearing his throat in Richard's direction, and then crossing over the boundary to look at his work, the two of them standing before it in silence, needing to exchange only the fewest of words, yet understanding exactly what the other meant. He spent so much time explaining yourself, your work, to others, what it meant, what you were trying to accomplish, why you were trying to accomplish it, why you had chosen the colors and subject matter and materials and application and technique that you had, that it was a relief to simply be with another person to whom you didn't have to explain anything. You could just look and look, and when you asked questions, they were usually blunt and technical and literal. You could be discussing engines or plumbing, a matter both mechanical and straightforward, for which there were only one or two possible answers. They all worked in different mediums, so there was no competition, no fear of one video artist finding representation before his studio mate, and less fear that a curator would come in to look at your work and fall in love with your neighbors instead. And yet, and this was important, he respected everyone else's work as well. Henry made what he called deconstructed sculptures, strange and elaborate ikebana arrangements of flowers and branches fashioned from various kinds of silk. After he'd finish a piece, though, he'd remove its chicken wire buttressing so that the sculpture fell to the ground as a flat object and appeared as an abstract puddle of colors. Only Henry knew what it looked like as a three-dimensional object. Ali was a photographer who was working on a series called The History of Asians in America, for which he created a photograph to represent every decade of Asians in America since 1890. For each image, he made a different diorama representing an epochal event or theme in one of the 3-foot square pine boxes that Richard had built for him which he populated with little plastic figures he bought at the craft store and painted, and trees and roads that he glazed from potter's clay, and backdrops he rendered with a brush whose bristles were so fine they resembled eyelashes. He then shot the dioramas and made sea prints. Of the four of them, only Ali was represented, and he had a show in 7 months, about which the other three knew never to ask because any mention of it made him start bleeding with anxiety. Ali wasn't progressing in historical order. He had the 2000s done, a stretch of lower Broadway thick with couples, all of whom were white men and walking just a few steps behind them, Asian women, and the 1980s, a tiny Chinese man being beaten by two tiny white thugs with wrenches, the bottom of the box greased with varnish to resemble a parking lot's rain-glossed tarmac, and was currently working on the 1940s, for which he was painting a cast of 50 men, women, and children who were meant to be prisoners in the Tule Lake internment camp. Ali's work was the most laborious of all of theirs, and sometimes, when they were procrastinating on their own projects, they would wander into Ali's cube and sit next to him, and Ali, barely lifting his head from the magnifying mirror under which he held a 3-inch figure on whom he was painting a herringbone skirt and saddle shoes, would hand them a snarl of steel wool that he needed shredded to resemble tumbleweeds, or some fine gauge wire that he wanted punctuated with little ties so that it would look barbed. But it was Richard's work that J.B. admired the most. He was a sculptor, too, but worked with only ephemeral materials. He'd draw on drafting paper impossible shapes, and then render them in ice, in butter, in chocolate, in lard, and film them as they vanished. He was gleeful about witnessing the disintegration of his works, but J.B., watching just last month as a massive, 8-foot-tall piece Richard had made, a swooping, sail-like bat wing of frozen grape juice that resembled coagulated blood, dripped and then crumbled to its demise, had found himself unexpectedly about to cry. Though whether from the destruction of something so beautiful or the mere everyday profundity of its disappearance, he was unable to say. Now Richard was less interested in substances that melted and more interested in substances that would attract decimators. He was particularly interested in moths, which apparently loved honey. He had a vision, he told J.B., of a sculpture whose surface so writhed with moths that you couldn't even see the shape of the thing they were devouring. The sills of his windows were lined with jars of honey in which the porous combs floated like fetuses suspended in formaldehyde. J.B. was the lone classicist among them. He painted. Worse, he was a figurative painter. When he had been in graduate school, no one really cared about figurative work. Anything, video art, performance art, photography, was more exciting than painting. And truly anything was better than figurative work. That's the way it's been since the 1950s, one of his professors had sighed when J.B. complained to him. You know that slogan for the Marines? The few, the brave? That's us. We lonely losers. It was not as if, over the years, he hadn't attempted other things, other mediums. That stupid, fake, derivative Merritt Oppenheim hair project. Could he have done anything cheaper? He and Malcolm had gotten into a huge fight, one of their biggest, when Malcolm had called the series Ersatz Lorna Simpson. And of course, the worst thing was that Malcolm had been completely right. But although he would never have admitted to anyone else that he felt there was something effete, girlish almost, and at any rate certainly not gangster about being a figurative painter, he had recently had to accept that it was what he was. He loved paint, and he loved portraiture, and that was what he was going to do. So, then what? He had known people, he knew people, who were technically much better artists than he was. They were better draftsmen, they had better senses of composition and color, they were more disciplined, but they didn't have any ideas. An artist, as much as a writer or composer, needed themes, needed ideas. And for a long time he simply didn't have any. He tried to draw only black people, but a lot of people drew black people. and he didn't feel he had anything new to add. He drew hustlers for a while, but that too grew dull. He drew his female relatives, but found himself coming back to the black problem. He began a series of scenes from Tintin books, with the characters portrayed realistically as humans, but it soon felt too ironic and hollow, and he stopped. So he lazed from canvas to canvas, doing paintings of people on the street, of people on the subway, of scenes from Ezra's many parties. These were the least successful. Everyone at those gatherings were the sort who dressed and moved as if they were constantly being observed, and he ended up with pages of studies of posing girls and preening guys, all of their eyes carefully averted from his gaze. Until one night, he was sitting in Jude and Willem's depressing apartment on their depressing sofa, watching the two of them assemble dinner, negotiating their way through their miniature kitchen like a bustling lesbian couple. This had been one of the rare Sunday nights he wasn't at his mother's, because she and his grandmother and aunts were all on a tacky cruise in the Mediterranean that he had refused to go on. But he had grown accustomed to seeing people and having dinner, a real dinner, made for him on Sundays, and so had invited himself over to Jude and Willem's, both of whom he knew would be home because neither of them had any money to go out. He had his sketch pad with him, as he always did, and when Jude sat down at the card table to chop onions, they had to do all their prep work on the table because there was no counter space in the kitchen, he began drawing him almost unthinkingly. From the kitchen came a great banging and the smell of smoking olive oil, and when he went in to discover Willem whacking at a piece of butterflied chicken with the bottom of an omelet pan, his arm raised over the meat as if to spank it, his expression oddly peaceful, he drew him as well. He wasn't sure then that he was really working toward anything, but the next weekend, when they all went out to Pho Viet Wong, he brought along one of Ali's old cameras and shot the three of them eating, and then later, walking up the street in the snow. They were moving particularly slowly in deference to Jude, because the sidewalks were slippery. He saw them lined up in the camera's viewfinder. Malcolm, Jude, and Willem. Malcolm and Willem on either side of Jude, close enough, he knew, having been in the position himself, to catch him if he skidded, but not so close that Jude would suspect that they were anticipating his fall. They had never had a conversation that they would do this, he realized. They had simply begun it. He took the picture. "What are you doing, J.B.?" asked Jude, at the same time as Malcolm complained, "Cut it out, J.B.." The party that night was on Center Street, in the loft of an acquaintance of theirs, a woman named Mirasol, whose twin, Phaedra, they knew from college. Once inside, everyone dispersed into their different subgroups, and J.B., after waving at Richard across the room and noting with irritation that Mirasol had provided a whole tableful of food, meaning that he'd just wasted $14 at Pho Viet Wong when he could have eaten here for free, found himself wandering toward where Jude was talking with Phaedra and some fat dude who might have been Phaedra's boyfriend, and a skinny, bearded guy he recognized as a friend of Jude's from work. Jude was perched on the back of one of the sofas, Phaedra next to him, and the two of them were looking up at the fat and skinny guys, and all of them were laughing at something. He took the picture. Normally at parties, he grabbed or was grabbed by a group of people and spent the night as the nuclei for a variety of three or foursomes, bounding from one to the next, gathering the gossip, starting harmless rumors, pretending to share confidences, getting others to tell him who they hated by divulging hatreds of his own. But this night, he traveled the room alert and purposeful, and largely sober, taking pictures of his three friends as they moved in their own patterns, unaware that he was trailing them. At one point, a couple of hours in, he found them by the window with just one another, Jude saying something and the other two leaning in close to hear him, and then in the next moment, the three of them leaning back and all laughing. And although for a moment he felt both wistful and slightly jealous, he was also triumphant, as he had gotten both shots. "Tonight I am a camera," he told himself. tomorrow I will be J.B. again. In a way, he had never enjoyed a party more, and no one seemed to notice his deliberate rovings, except for Richard, who, as the four of them were leaving an hour later to go uptown, Malcolm's parents were in the country, and Malcolm thought he knew where his mother hid her weed, gave him an unexpectedly sweet old man clap on the shoulder. Working on something?
I think so.
Good for you. The next day, he sat at his computer looking at the night's images on the screen. The camera wasn't a great one, and it had hazed every picture with a smoky yellow light, which, along with his poor focusing skills, had made everyone warm and rich and slightly soft-edged, as if they had been shot through a tumbler full of whiskey. He stopped at a close-up of Willem's face, of him smiling at someone, a girl, no doubt, off-camera, and at the one of Jude and Phaedra on the sofa. Jude was wearing a bright navy sweater that J.B. could never figure out belonged to him or to Willem, as both of them wore it so much, and Phaedra was wearing a wool dress the shade of port as she was leaning her head toward his, and the dark of her hair made his look lighter, and the nubbly teal of the sofa beneath them made them both appear shining and jewel-like, their colors just licked and glorious, their skin delicious. They were colors anyone would want to paint, and so he did, sketching out the scene first in his book in pencil, and then again on stiffer board in watercolors, and then finally on canvas in acrylics. That had been 4 months ago, and he now had almost 11 paintings completed, an astonishing output for him, all of scenes from his friends' lives. There was Willem waiting to audition, studying the script a final time, the sole of one boot pressed against the sticky red wall behind him, and Jude at a play, his face half-shadowed at the very second he smiled. Getting that shot had almost gotten J.B. thrown out of the theater. Malcolm sitting stiffly on a sofa a few feet away from his father, his back straight and his hands clenching his knees, the two of them watching a Buñuel film on a television just out of frame. After some experimentation, he had settled on canvases the size of a standard C print, 20 by 24 inches, all horizontally oriented, and which he imagined might someday be displayed in a long, snaking single layer, one that would wrap itself around a gallery's walls, each image following the next as fluidly as cells in a film strip. The renderings were realistic, but photorealistic. He had never replaced Dalí's camera with a better one, and he tried to make each painting capture that gently fuzzed quality the camera gave everything, as if someone had patted away the top layer of clarity and left behind something kinder than the eye alone could see. In his insecure moments, he sometimes worried the project was too fey, too inward. This was where having representation really helped, if only to remind you that someone liked your work, thought it important, or at the very least, beautiful. But he couldn't deny the pleasure he got from it, the sense of ownership and contentment. At times he missed being part of the pictures himself. Here was a whole narrative of his friends' lives, his absence an enormous missing part, but he also enjoyed the godlike role he played. He got to see his friends differently, not as just appendages to his life, but as distinct characters inhabiting their own stories. He felt sometimes that he was seeing them for the first time, even after so many years of knowing them. About a month into the project, once he knew that this was what he was going to concentrate on, he'd of course had to explain to them why he kept following them around with a camera, shooting the mundane moments of their lives, and why it was crucial that they let him keep doing so and provide him with as much access as possible. They had been at dinner at a Vietnamese noodle shop on Orchard Street that they hoped might be a Pho Viet Hoang successor, and after he'd made his speech, uncharacteristically nervous as he did so, they all found themselves looking toward Jude, who he'd known in advance would be the problem. The other two would agree, but that didn't help him. They all needed to say yes, or it wouldn't work, and Jude was by far the most self-conscious among them. In college, He turned his head or blocked his face whenever anyone tried to take his picture. And whenever he had smiled or laughed, he had reflexively covered his mouth with his hand, a tic that the rest of them had found upsetting, and which he had only learned to stop doing in the past few years. As he'd feared, Jude was suspicious. "What would this involve?" he kept asking, and J.B., summoning all his patience, had to reassure him numerous times that of course his goal wasn't to humiliate or exploit him, but only to chronicle in pictures the drip of all of their lives. The others said nothing, letting him do the work, and Jude finally consented, although he didn't sound too happy about it.
"How long is this going to go on for?" Jude asked.
"Forever, I hope." And he did. His one regret was that he hadn't begun earlier, back when they were all young. On the way out, he walked with Jude.
"Jude," he said quietly, so that the others couldn't hear him, "anything that involves you, I'll let you see in advance. You veto it, and I'll never show it."
Jude looked at him.
"Promise?"
"Swear to God." He regretted his offer the instant he made it, for the truth was that Jude was his favorite of the three of them to paint. He was the most beautiful of them, with the most interesting face and the most unusual coloring, and he was the shyest, and so pictures of him always felt more precious than ones of the others. The following Sunday, when he was back at his mother's, he went through some of his boxes from college that he'd stored in his old bedroom, looking for a photograph he knew he had. Finally, he found it, a picture of Jude from their first year that someone had taken and printed, and which had somehow ended up in his possession. In it, Jude was standing in the living room of their suite, turned partway to the camera. His left arm was wrapped around his chest so you could see the satiny starburst-shaped scar on the back of his hand, and in his right, he was unconvincingly holding an unlit cigarette. He was wearing a blue and white striped long-sleeved t-shirt that must not have been his, it was so big, although maybe it really was his. In those days, all of Jude's clothes were too big because, as it later emerged, he intentionally bought them oversized so he could wear them for the next few years as he grew. And his hair, which he wore longish back then so he could hide behind it, fizzled off at his jawline. But the thing that J.B. had always remembered most about this photograph was the expression on Jude's face, a wariness that in those days he was never without. He hadn't looked at this picture in years, but doing so made him feel empty for reasons he wasn't quite able to articulate. This was the painting he was working on now, and for it he had broken form and changed to a 40-inch square canvas. He had experimented for days to get right that precise shade of tricky, serpenty green for Jude's irises, and had redone the colors of his hair again and again before he was satisfied. It was a great painting, and he knew it. Knew it absolutely, the way you sometimes did, and he had no intention of ever showing it to Jude until it was hanging on a gallery wall somewhere, and Jude would be powerless to do anything about it. He knew Jude would hate how fragile, how feminine, how vulnerable, how young it made him look, and knew, too, he would find lots of other imaginary things to hate about it as well, things J.B. couldn't even begin to anticipate because he wasn't a self-loathing nutjob like Jude. But to him, it expressed everything about what he hoped this series would be. It was a love letter, it was a documentation, it was a saga, it was his. When he worked on this painting, he felt sometimes as if he were flying, as if the world of galleries and parties and other artists and ambitions had shrunk to a pinpoint beneath him. Something so small he could kick it away from himself like a soccer ball, watch it spin off into some distant orbit that had nothing to do with him. It was almost 6. The light would change soon. For now, the space was still quiet around him, although distantly he could hear the train rumbling by on its tracks. Before him, his canvas waited, and so he picked up his brush and began.
There was poetry on the subway. Above the rows of scooped plastic seats, filling the empty display space between ads for dermatologists and companies that promised college degrees by mail, were long laminated sheets printed with poems. Second-rate Stevens and third-rate Retke and fourth-rate Lowell, verse meant to agitate no one, anger and beauty reduced to empty aphorisms. Or so J.B. always said. He was against the poems. They had appeared when he was in junior high, and for the past 15 years he had been complaining about them. Instead of funding real art and real artists, they're giving money to a bunch of spinster librarians and cardigan fags to pick out this shit, he shouted at Willem over the screech of the F-train's brakes. And it's all this Edna St. Vincent Millay type shit. Or it's actually good people they've neutered. And they're all white. Have you noticed that? What the fuck is up with that? The following week, Willem saw a Langston Hughes poster and called J.B. to tell him. Langston Hughes? J.B. groaned. Let me guess, a dream deferred, right? I knew it. That shit doesn't count. And anyway, if something really did explode, that shit'd be down in 2 seconds flat. Opposite Willem that afternoon is a Tom Gunn poem. Their relationship consisted in discussing if it existed. Underneath, someone had written, in black marker, "Don't worry, man, I can't get no pussy either." He closes his eyes. It's not promising that he's this tired and it's only 4, his shift not even begun. He shouldn't have gone with J.B. to Brooklyn the previous night, but no one else would go with him. And J.B. claimed he owed him because hadn't he accompanied Willem to his friend's horrible one-man show just last month? So he'd gone, of course. Whose band is this? He'd asked as they waited on the platform. Willem's coat was too thin, and he'd lost one of his gloves, and as a result, he had begun assuming a heat-conserving posture. Arms wrapped around his chest, hands folded into his armpits, rocking back on his heels whenever he was forced to stand still in the cold. Joseph's, said J.B. Oh, he said. He had no idea who Joseph was. He admired J.B.'s Fellini-esque command of his vast social circle, in which everyone was a colorfully costumed extra, and he and Malcolm and Jude were crucial but still lowly accessories to his vision. Key grips or second art directors, whom he regarded as tacitly responsible for keeping the entire endeavor grinding along. It's hardcore, said J.B. pleasantly, as if that would help him place Joseph. What's this band called? Okay, here's the thing, J.B. said, grinning. It's called Smegma Cake 2. What? He asked, laughing. Smegma Cake 2? Why, what happened to Smegma Cake 1? It got a staph infection, J.B. shouted over the noise of the train clattering into the station. An older woman standing near them scowled in their direction. Unsurprisingly, Smegma Cake 2 wasn't very good. It wasn't even hardcore, really, more ska-like, bouncy and meandering. Something happened to their sound, J.B. yelled into his ear during one of the more prolonged numbers, Phantom Snatch 3000. Yeah, he yelled back. It sucks. Midway through the concert, each song seeming to last 20 minutes, he grew giddy at both the absurdity of the band and the crammedness of the space, and began inexpertly moshing with J.B., the two of them springing off their neighbors and bystanders until everyone was crashing into one another, but cheerfully, like a bunch of tipsy toddlers. J.B. catching him by the shoulders and the two of them laughing into each other's faces. It was in these moments that he loved J.B. completely. His ability and willingness to be wholly silly and frivolous, which he could never be with Malcolm or Jude. Malcolm, because he was, for all his talk otherwise, interested in propriety. And Jude, because he was serious. Of course, this morning he had suffered. He woke in J.B.'s corner of Ezra's loft, on J.B.'s unmade mattress, nearby on the floor, J.B. himself snored juicily into a pile of peaty-smelling laundry, unsure how exactly they'd gotten back over the bridge. Willem wasn't normally a drinker or a stoner, but around J.B. he occasionally found himself behaving otherwise. It had been a relief to return to Lispenard Street. It's quiet and clean, the sunlight that baked his side of the bedroom hot and loafy between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. already slanting through the window. Jude long gone for the day. He set his alarm and fell instantly asleep, waking with enough time only to shower and swallow an aspirin before hurrying to the train. The restaurant where he worked had made its reputation on both its food, which was complicated without being challenging, and its consistency and approachability of its staff. At Ortolan, they were taught to be warm but not familiar, accessible but not informal. "It's not friendlies," his boss, Finley, the restaurant's general manager, liked to say. "Smile, but don't tell people your name." There were lots of rules such as these at Ortolan. Women employees could wear their wedding rings, but no other jewelry. Men shouldn't wear their hair longer than the bottom of their earlobes. No nail polish. No more than 2 days' worth of beard. Mustaches were to be tolerated on a case-by-case basis, as were tattoos. Willem had been a waiter at Ortolan for almost 2 years. Before Ortolan, he had worked the weekend brunch and weekday lunch shift at a loud and popular restaurant in Chelsea called Digits, where the customers, almost always men, almost always older, 40 at least, would ask him if he was on the menu, and then laugh, naughty and pleased with themselves, as if they were the first people to ever ask him that, instead of the 11th or 12th that shift alone. Even so, he always smiled and said, "Only as an appetizer." And they'd retort, "But I want an entree." And he would smile again, and they would tip him well at the end. It had been a friend of his from graduate school, another actor named Roman, who'd recommended him to Finley after he'd booked a recurring guest role on a soap opera and had quit. He was conflicted about accepting the gig, he told Willem, but what could he do? It was too much money to refuse. Willem had been glad for the referral because, besides its food and service, the other thing that Ortolan was known for, albeit among a much smaller group of people, was its flexible hours, especially if Finley liked you. Finley liked small, flat-chested brunette women and all sorts of men as long as they were tall and thin and, it was rumored, not Asian. Sometimes Willem would stand on the edge of the kitchen and watch as mismatched pairs of tiny dark-haired waitresses and long, skinny men circled through the main dining room, skating past one another in a weirdly cast series of minuets. Not everyone who waited at Ortolan was an actor. Or to be more precise, not everyone at Ortolan was still an actor. There were certain restaurants in New York where one went from being an actor who waited tables to somehow being a waiter who was once an actor. And if the restaurant was good enough, respected enough, that was not only a perfectly acceptable career transition, it was a preferable one. A waiter at a well-regarded restaurant could get his friends a coveted reservation, could charm the kitchen staff into sending out free dishes to those same friends, though, as Willem learned, charming the kitchen staff was less easy than he'd thought it would be. But what could an actor who waited tables get his friends? Tickets to yet another off-Broadway production for which you had to supply your own suit because you were playing a stockbroker who may or may not be a zombie, and yet there was no money for costumes? He'd had to do exactly that last year, and because he didn't have a suit of his own, he'd had to borrow one of Jude's. Jude's legs were about an inch longer than his, and so for the duration of the run he'd had to fold the pants legs under and stick them in place with masking tape. It was easy to tell who at Ortolan was once an actor and was now a career waiter. The careerists were older, for one, and precise and fussy about enforcing Finley's rules, and at staff dinners they would ostentatiously swirl the wine that the sommelier's assistant poured them to sample and say things like, "It's a little like that Linne Collodo Petit Sirah you served last week, Jose, isn't it? Or tastes a little minerally, doesn't it? This is New Zealand?" It was understood that you didn't ask them to come to your productions. You only asked your fellow actor waiters, and if you were asked, it was considered polite to at least try to go, and you certainly didn't discuss auditions or agents or anything of the sort with them. Acting was like a war, and they were veterans. They didn't want to think about the war, and they certainly didn't want to talk about it with naifs who were still eagerly dashing toward the trenches, who were still excited to be in country. Findlay himself was a former actor, but unlike the other former actors, he liked to, or perhaps liked was not the word, perhaps the more accurate word would be simply did, talk about his past life, or at least a certain version of it. According to Findlay, he had once almost booked the second lead in the public theater production of A Bright Room Called Day. Later, one of the waitresses had told them that all of the significant roles in the play were for women. He had understudied a part on Broadway, for what production was never made clear. Findlay was a walking career memento mori, a cautionary tale in a gray wool suit, and the still actors either avoided him, as if his particular curse were something contagious, or studied him closely, as if by remaining in contact with him, they could inoculate themselves. But at what point had Findlay decided he would give up acting, and how had it happened? Was it simply age? He was, after all, old, 45, 50, somewhere around there. How did you know that it was time to give up? Was it when you were 38 and still hadn't found an agent, as they suspected had happened to Joel? Was it when you were 40 and still had a roommate and were making more as a part-time waiter than you had made the year you decided to be a full-time actor, as they knew had happened to Kevin? Was it when you got fat or bald or got bad plastic surgery that couldn't disguise the fact that you were fat and bald? When did pursuing your ambitions cross the line from brave into foolhardy? How did you know when to stop? In earlier, more rigid, less encouraging, and ultimately more helpful decades, things would be much clearer. You would stop when you turned 40, or when you got married, or when you had kids, or after 5 years, or 10 years, or 15. And then you would go get a real job, and acting and your dreams for a career in it would recede into the evening, a melting into history as quiet as a briquette of ice sliding into a warm bath. But these were days of self-fulfillment, where settling for something that was not quite your first choice of a life seemed weak-willed and ignoble. Somewhere, surrendering to what seemed to be your fate had changed from being dignified to being a sign of your own cowardice. There were times when the pressure to achieve happiness felt almost oppressive, as if happiness were something that everyone should and could attain, and that any sort of compromise in its pursuit was somehow your fault. Would Willem work for year upon year at Ortolan, catching the same trains to auditions, reading again and again and again, 1 year maybe caterpillaring an inch or two forward, his progress so minute that it hardly counted as progress at all? Would he someday have the courage to give up? And would he be able to recognize that moment, or would he wake one day and look in the mirror and find himself an old man, still trying to call himself an actor because he was too scared to admit that he might not be, might never be? According to J.B., the reason Willem wasn't yet successful was because of Willem. One of J.B.'s favorite lectures to him began with, "If I had your looks, Willem," and ended with, "And now you've been so fucking spoiled by things coming to you so easily that you think everything's just going to happen for you. And you know what, Willem? You're good-looking, but everyone here is good-looking, and you're just going to have to try harder." Even though he thought this was sort of ironic coming from J.B., spoiled? Look at J.B.'s family, all of them clucking after him, pushing on him his favorite foods and just iron shirts, surrounding him in a cloud of compliments and affection. He once overheard J.B. on the phone telling his mother he needed her to get him more underwear and that he'd pick it up when he went to see her for Sunday dinner, for which, by the way, he wanted short ribs. He understood what he meant as well. He knew he wasn't lazy, but the truth was that he lacked the sort of ambition that J.B. and Jude had, that grim, trudging determination that kept them at the studio or office longer than anyone else, that gave them that slightly faraway look in their eyes that always made him think, A fraction of them was already living in some imagined future, the contours of which were crystallized only to them. JB's ambition was fueled by a lust for that future, for his speedy arrival to it. Jude's, he thought, was motivated more by a fear that if he didn't move forward, he would somehow slip back to his past, the life he had left and about which he would tell none of them. And it wasn't only Jude and JB who possessed this quality. New York was populated by the ambitious. It was often the only thing that everyone here had in common. Ambition and atheism. "Ambition is my only religion," JB had told him late one beery night, and although to Willem this line sounded a little too practiced, like he was rehearsing it, trying to perfect its careless, throwaway tone before he someday got to say it for real to an interviewer somewhere, he also knew that JB was sincere. Only here did you feel compelled to somehow justify anything short of rabidity for your career. Only here did you have to apologize for having faith in something other than yourself. The city often made him feel he was missing something essential, and that that ignorance would forever doom him to a life at Ortolan. He had felt this in college as well, where he knew absolutely that he was the dumbest person in their class, admitted as a sort of unofficial, poor, white, rural dweller oddity affirmative action representative. The others, he thought, sensed this as well, although it seemed to truly bother only J.B. "I don't know about you sometimes, Willem," J.B. once said to him, in a tone that suggested that what he didn't know about Willem wasn't good. This was late last year, shortly after Merritt, Willem's former roommate, had gotten one of the two lead roles in an off-Broadway revival of True West. The other lead was being played by an actor who had recently starred in an acclaimed independent film and was enjoying that brief moment of possessing both downtown credibility and the promise of more mainstream success. The director, someone Willem had been longing to work with, had promised he'd cast an unknown as the second lead. And he had. It was just that the unknown was Merritt and not Willem. The two of them had been the final contenders for the part. His friends had been outraged on his behalf. "But Merritt doesn't even know how to act," JB had groaned. "He just stands on stage and sparkles and thinks that's enough." The three of them had started talking about the last thing they had seen Merritt in, an all-male, off-off-Broadway production of La Traviata set in 1980s Fire Island. Violetta, played by Merritt, had been renamed Victor, and he had died of AIDS, not tuberculosis, and they all agreed it had been barely watchable. "Well, he does have a good look," he'd said, in a weak attempt to defend his absent former roommate. "He's not that good-looking," Malcolm said, with a vehemence that surprised all of them. "Willem, it'll happen," Jude consoled him on the way back home after dinner. "If there's any justice in the world, it'll happen. That director's an imbecile." But Jude never blamed Willem for his failings. JB always did. He wasn't sure which was less helpful. He had been grateful for their anger, naturally, but the truth was, he didn't think Merritt was as bad as they did. He was certainly no worse than Willem himself. In fact, he was probably better. Later, he'd told this to JB, who responded with a long silence, stuffed with disapproval, before he started lecturing Willem. "I don't know about you sometimes, Willem," he began. "Sometimes I get the sense you don't even really want to be an actor." "That's not true," he'd protested. "It's just that I don't think that every rejection is meaningless, and I don't think everyone who gets a job over me does so out of dumb luck." There had been another silence. "You're too kind, Willem," JB said, darkly. "You're never going to get anywhere like this." "Thanks, JB," he'd said. He was rarely offended by JB's opinions. Often he was right. But at that particular moment, he didn't much feel like hearing JB's thoughts on his shortcomings and his gloomy predictions about his future unless he completely changed his personality. He'd gotten off the phone and had lain in bed awake, feeling stuck and sorry for himself. Anyway, changing his personality seemed basically out of the question. Wasn't it too late? Before he was a kind man, after all, Willem had been a kind boy. Everyone had noticed, his teachers, his classmates, the parents of his classmates. Willem is such a compassionate child, his teachers would write on his report cards his mother or father would look at once, briefly and wordlessly, before adding them to the stacks of newspapers and empty envelopes that they'd take to the recycling center. As he grew older, he had begun to realize that people were surprised, even upset, by his parents. A high school teacher had once blurted to him that, given Willem's temperament, he had thought his parents would be different. "Different how?" he'd asked. "Friendlier," his teacher had said. He didn't think of himself as particularly generous or unusually good-spirited. Most things came easily to him. Sports, school, friends, girls. He wasn't nice, necessarily. He didn't seek to be everyone's friend, and he couldn't tolerate bores or pettiness or meanness. He was humble and hard-working, diligent, he knew, rather than brilliant. "Know your place," his father often said to him. His father did. Willem remembered once, after a late spring freeze had killed off a number of new lambs in their area, his father being interviewed by a newspaper reporter who was writing a story about how it had affected the local farms. "As a rancher," the reporter began, when Willem's father had stopped her.
"Not a rancher," he'd said,
his accent making these words, as all words, sound brusquer than they should.
"A ranch hand."
He was correct, of course. A rancher meant something specific, a landowner. And by that definition, he wasn't a rancher. But there were plenty of other people in the county who then also had no right to call themselves ranchers and yet did so anyway. Willem had never heard his father say that they shouldn't. His father didn't care what anyone else did or didn't do. But such inflation was not for him or for his wife, Willem's mother. Perhaps because of this, he felt he always knew who and what he was, which is why, as he moved farther and then further away from the ranch and his childhood, he felt very little pressure to change or reinvent himself. He was a guest at his college, a guest in graduate school, and now he was a guest in New York, a guest in the lives of the beautiful and the rich. He would never try to pretend he was born to such things, because he knew he wasn't. He was a ranch hand son from western Wyoming, and his leaving didn't mean that everything he had once been was erased, written over by time and experiences and the proximity to money. He was his parents' fourth child, and the only one still alive. First, there had been a girl, Britta, who had died of leukemia when she was 2, long before Willem had been born. This had been in Sweden, when his father, who was Icelandic, had been working at a fish farm, where he had met his mother, who was Danish. Then there had been a move to America, and a boy, Hemming, who had been born with cerebral palsy. 3 years later, there had been another boy, Axel, who had died in his sleep as an infant for no apparent reason. Hemming was 8 when Willem was born. He couldn't walk or speak, but Willem had loved him and had never thought of him as anything but his older brother. Hemming could smile, however, and as he did, he'd bring his hand up toward his face, his fingers shaping themselves into a duck's bill claw, his lips pulling back from his azalea pink gums. Willem learned to crawl, and then walk and run, Hemming remaining in his chair year after year, and when he was old and strong enough, he would push Hemming's heavy chair with its fat, stubborn tires. This was a chair meant to be sedentary, not to be nosed through grasses or down dirt roads, around the ranch where they lived with their parents in a small wooden house. Up the hill from them was the main house, long and low, with a deep wraparound porch, and down the hill from them were the stables where their parents spent their days. He had been Hemming's primary caretaker and companion all through high school. In the mornings, he was the first one awake, making his parents coffee and boiling water for Hemming's oatmeal, and in the evenings, he waited by the side of the road for the van that would drop his brother off after his day at the assisted living center an hour's drive away. Willem always thought they clearly looked like brothers. They had their parents' light, bright hair, and their father's gray eyes, and both of them had a groove, like an elongated parenthesis, bracketing the left side of their mouths that made them appear easily amused and ready to smile. But no one else seemed to notice this. They only saw that Hemming was in a wheelchair, and that his mouth remained open, a damp red ellipse, and that his eyes, more often than not, drifted skyward, fixed on some cloud only he could see. "What do you see, Hemming?" he sometimes asked him when they were out on their night walks, but of course Hemming never answered him. Their parents were efficient and competent with Hemming, but not, he recognized, particularly affectionate. When Willem was kept late at school because of a football game or a track meet, or when he was needed to work an extra shift at the grocery store, it was his mother who waited for Hemming at the end of the drive, who hefted Hemming into and then out of his bath, who fed him his dinner of chicken and rice porridge and changed his diaper before putting him to bed. But she didn't read to him, or talk to him, or go on walks with him the way Willem did. Watching his parents around Hemming bothered him, in part because, although they never behaved objectionably, he could tell that they viewed Hemming as their responsibility, but no more. Later he would argue with himself that that was all that could reasonably be expected of them. Anything else would be luck. But still, he wished they loved Hemming more, just a little more. Although maybe love was too much to ask from his parents. They had lost so many children that perhaps they simply either wouldn't or couldn't surrender themselves wholly to the ones they now had. Eventually both he and Hemming would leave them too, by choice or not, and then their losses would be complete. But it would be decades before he was able to see things this way. His second year of college, Hemming had to have an emergency appendectomy. "They said they caught it just in time," his mother told him over the phone. Her voice was flat, very matter of fact. There was no relief in it, no anguish, but neither was there any, and he'd had to make himself consider this, even though he hadn't wanted to, was scared to, disappointment either. Hemming's caregiver, a local woman paid to watch him during the night now that Willem was gone, had noticed him pawing at his stomach and moaning, and had been able to diagnose the hard, truffly lump under his abdomen for what it was. While Hemming was being operated on, the doctors had found a growth, a few centimeters long, on his large intestine, and had biopsied it. X-rays had revealed further growths, and they were going to excise those as well. "I'll come home," he said. "No," his mother had said. "You can't do anything here. We'll tell you if it's anything serious." She and his father had been more bemused than anything when he had been admitted to college. Neither of them had known he was applying, but now that he was there, they were determined that he should graduate and forget the ranch as quickly as possible. But at night he thought of Hemming, alone in a hospital bed, how he'd be frightened and would cry and listen for the sound of his voice. When Hemming was 21, he'd had to have a hernia removed, and he had wept until Willem held his hand. He knew he'd have to go back. The flights were expensive, much more than he'd anticipated. He researched bus routes, but it would take 3 days to get there, 3 days to get back, and he had midterm exams he had to take and do well in if he was to keep his scholarship and his jobs to attend to. Finally, drunk that Friday night, he confided in Malcolm, who got out his checkbook and wrote him a check. "I can't," he said immediately. "Why not?" said Malcolm. They argued back and forth until Willem finally accepted the check. "I'll pay you back. You know that, right?" Malcolm shrugged. "There's no way for me to say this without sounding like a complete asshole," he said. "But it doesn't make a difference to me, Willem." Still, it became important to him to repay Malcolm somehow, even though he knew Malcolm wouldn't accept his money. It was Jude who had the idea of putting the money directly into Malcolm's wallet and so every 2 weeks after he'd cashed his check from the restaurant where he worked on the weekends, he'd stuff 2 or 3 20s into it while Malcolm was asleep. He never quite knew if Malcolm noticed. He spent it so quickly and often on the three of them, but Willem took